We spend a ridiculous amount of time thinking about food. I mean, what's for dinner? Is this avocado ripe? Did I eat too many carbs? It's survival, obviously, but it's also culture, it's comfort, it's how we socialize.
Oh, absolutely. It's a huge part of the human experience.
But I want you to imagine something for a second. Imagine the engine is running fine, like your stomach works, your intestines are ready to go, but the fuel line is cut.
Right.
You can't swallow, you can't chew, the entry door is locked. And historically, that was it. Game over.
Yeah, for a long time it really was. If
Yeah.
you couldn't get food past the throat, you starved.
But we have a workaround now. And that's exactly what we are digging into today. We are doing a deep dive into the source material on enteral nutrition.
Or tube feeding, as most people know it.
Exactly. And I'll be honest, when I first looked at the stack of medical texts and nursing guidelines, I thought, okay, tube feeding. Medical smoothies. How
Yeah.
complex can it be?
I think a lot of people assume it's just a blender and a tube.
Right. But the engineering and the high-stakes decision-making here is actually kind of terrifying. We're going to unpack how modern medicine bypasses the oral route entirely.
It's a really complex intersection of anatomy, fluid dynamics, and chemistry. We're looking at how to keep the machinery running without accidentally hurting the patient.
And we are pulling from a really comprehensive stack of sources today. We've got nursing skills manuals for insertion, pediatric guidelines, and safety standards from Canadian and US health agencies.
All of which paint a very vivid picture of the risks involved.
Yeah, we're talking about the hardware, the dangers, like literally drowning someone in their own dinner, and the weirdly profound psychological stuff that happens when you stop eating. So let's get into the plumbing.
Let's do it.
First off, I want to challenge the basic premise here, because if someone can't eat, we have IVs, right? We see it in movies all the time. Just hook a bag of nutrients to a vein and call it a day. Why are we bothering with shoving tubes down noses?
That is the million-dollar question. And the answer is a phrase you will hear in every single ICU: use it or lose it.
Meaning the gut itself.
Exactly. The gut is a muscle, essentially. If you stop using the gastrointestinal tract, the stomach and intestines, it actually starts to atrophy. Yeah,
Wow.
the lining breaks down. And worse, the bacteria that usually stay safely inside the gut can start crossing the weakened barrier into the bloodstream.
Yikes. So feeding through a vein, which the texts call parenteral nutrition, that's just avoiding the gut entirely.
Right. Parenteral nutrition uses the veins. Enteral nutrition uses the GI tract. And feeding through a vein is way more expensive, and it carries a much higher risk of infection.
So the golden rule is if the gut works, use the gut.
Always.
Yeah.
Even if the mouth is completely out of commission, enteral feeding is safer and physiologically more efficient.
Okay, so who are the candidates for this? I assume we aren't just talking about coma patients.
Not at all. It's really for anyone who has a working digestive system but cannot ingest safely. So think about someone with severe anorexia or head and neck cancer where a tumor is blocking the path.
Or I saw in the sources, extensive burns.
Yes, burn victims need massive amounts of calories to heal their skin. Way more than they could physically chew in a day.
Or maybe someone with a neurological condition who just lost the reflex to swallow.
Right. If you try to feed them orally, the food might go into their trachea, their airway, instead of their esophagus. So we need a bypass.
Now let's talk about the menu, because I definitely had this cartoon image in my head that the hospital kitchen just blends up a steak and potatoes and pours it into a funnel.
Please never do that. If you put blended steak in a feeding tube, you're going to have a very bad day.
It'll just clog, right?
Instantly. It's all highly engineered formula. The caloric density varies, usually from 1.0 to 2.0 kilocalories per milliliter.
And this is where we run into a concept that sounds dry but is actually super critical: osmolality.
Yes, osmolality.
It sounds like something from a high school chemistry final.
It does, but it basically refers to the concentration of particles in the formula. Here is the simple version. Imagine a really crowded party in a small room. That is a high osmolality formula. Lots of broken down nutrients, proteins, and sugars packed tight.
So what does the body do with that crowded party?
Well, the intestine doesn't like it. It tries to dilute the crowd. So it pulls water from the rest of the body into the intestine to space things out.
Oh, I see where this is going.
If that happens too fast, you get what we call dumping syndrome. The patient gets cramping, a rapid heart rate, and severe diarrhea because the gut is suddenly flooded with water.
So you're trying to feed them, but you might accidentally just dehydrate them and cause a massive mess because the formula is too intense.
Exactly. It's a real balancing act. You need to deliver nutrients, but you can't overwhelm the gut's ability to handle the particle concentration.
And that thickness, the density of the formula, it actually dictates the hardware too. You can't push a thick sludge through a tiny straw. Which brings us to the tubes themselves.
The alphabet soup of tubes.
Right. We've got NG, which is nosogastric, nose to stomach. The texts say that's short term, like less than 4 weeks.
Yes. And then NI, nesointestinal. That goes from the nose all the way into the small intestine. We use that if the patient has terrible reflux or a high risk of aspirating food into their lungs because it deposits the food below the pyloric sphincter.
Kept safely away from the throat. And then for long-term needs, over 4 to 6 weeks, you've got the PEG tubes, the gastrostomy, which goes surgically straight through the abdominal wall.
Exactly.
But the sizing chart was fascinating. It mentions the French scale. And with needles, a bigger number means a smaller needle. Is it the same here?
Thankfully, no. In the French scale, the logic holds up. A bigger number means a bigger tube. So a size 8 French is tiny, kind of like a cocktail straw.
And a 14 or 16 is getting closer to a boba tea straw.
Exactly.
So for feeding, I assume we want the boba straw to get the formula through.
Actually, no. For feeding, especially through the nose, you want the smallest tube possible, usually an 8 to 12. You want it soft and flexible, made of polyurethane or silicone, so it's comfortable for the patient.
But wait, didn't we just say thick formula clogs, small tubes?
We did, and that is the trade-off. Small tubes are comfortable, but they are prone to clogging. If a nurse doesn't crush a medication into an absolute perfect dust powder before putting it in, that tube is done.
You'd have to pull it out and start over.
And nobody wants that.
But I saw there are big tubes, those rigid 14s and 16s. What are they for, if not feeding?
Decompression. They're used to take things out. Say you have a bowel obstruction or your gut just stops moving. Peristalsis stops. Gastric juices are still being made and they have nowhere to go.
So you'll throw up.
Right. So we put down a large bore, rigid tube to suction all those secretions out.
Which leads me to the most fascinating piece of engineering in this whole stack, the Salem sump.
Ah, yes.
It's a decompression tube, but it has two lumens, two channels. There's the main tube to suck things out, but then there's this little blue pigtail hanging off the side.
The blue pigtail is iconic in nursing.
And the nursing manuals are basically screaming in all caps, never clamp the blue pigtail, never put fluids in it. But to a little person, it looks like a leak. Why is it there?
It is an air vent. Think about when you finish a milkshake and you keep sucking on the straw collapses, or it sucks onto the side of the plastic cup and gets stuck.
Oh boy, I'm making that awful noise.
Now imagine that happening inside your stomach. If you have a suction machine pulling fluid out and the stomach empties, the main tube is going to grab onto the stomach lining.
Ouch, like a vacuum hickey on the inside of your stomach.
Basically, and it could severely damage the tissue, causing bleeding or ulcers. So the blue pigtail allows air to flow in, which breaks the vacuum. It lets the tube float freely so it doesn't eat the stomach wall.
So if a well-meaning person sees this blue tube leaking a little air and clamps it off,
they're turning that tube into a vacuum weapon against the patient's stomach lining.
Note to self, do not touch the blue pigtail. Okay, so we've got the tube selected. Now we have to get it in. And this is the part that made my eyes water just reading about it. Because for a nasogastric tube, you are sliding a plastic hose up someone's nose while they are completely awake.
It is not a pleasant experience. It causes a sharp burning sensation in the nasal mucosa. There's a lot of gagging and watery eyes.
But the thing that really freaks me out is that the insertion is blind. You can't see where the tip is going inside their body.
You're relying entirely on anatomy, patient positioning, and technique. But yes, you cannot see the path.
And the stakes are wildly high because the esophagus, where the food goes, is right next door to the trachea, where the air goes.
They're very close neighbors. And if that tube takes a wrong turn and slips into the bronchus, into the lungs, and you start pumping in formula,
you're filling their lungs with fluid.
You are drowning them. It can cause severe pneumonia, infection, and it can absolutely be fatal.
So you've wrestled this tube into a patient. How do you know? How are you 100% sure that you aren't in the lungs?
There is only one way to be 100% sure before that very first feeding. Radiographic film. An X-ray.
The gold standard.
The absolute gold standard. You put the tube in, you send it to radiology, and you do not put a single drop of anything down that tube until a doctor looks at the film and confirms gastric placement. Guessing is dangerous.
Okay, but you can't x-ray someone every few hours. So let's say the tube has been in for a day. The patient was coughing a lot. The nurse needs to check if the tube shifted out of place. The text called this bedside detective work.
It is detective work because you have to look for indirect clues.
The main one being the pH test, right?
Yes. You aspirate, you pull back a little fluid from the tube with a syringe, and you test the acidity. The stomach is an acid pit, so the pH is usually 5 or less. The lungs and the intestines are alkaline, so their pH is 6 or higher.
So if the paper turns the color for acid, you're safe.
You are likely safe. You also do a visual check of the fluid. Stomach aspirate is usually a grassy green or clear. If it's yellow or bile stained, the tube might have slipped past the stomach and into the intestine.
Now, I have to ask about this one method because I feel like I've seen it on every medical TV drama. The auscultation method or the whoosh test.
Ooh.
The doctor puts a stethoscope on the stomach, injects some air into the tube, and listens for a bubbling whoosh sound.
The whoosh test is a myth and a very dangerous red herring.
Really? Because it sounds so logical.
It does sound logical.
Well.
But rigorous research showed that air moving through a tube that is coiled in the lungs can sound terrifyingly similar to air moving into the stomach. It is completely unreliable.
Wow.
The guidelines are incredibly strict now. Auscultation should never be used to distinguish between gastric and respiratory placement.
Yeah.
Because of a false sense of security.
Okay, scratch the whoosh off the list entirely. So the tube is in, it's verified with an x-ray, now we're feeding. But the safety protocols don't stop there. It seems like gravity is a major enemy here.
Gravity is huge. Normally you have sphincter valves that keep food in the stomach. But when you have a tube holding that valve open, or if the patient is just very weak, there is nothing stopping the formula from backing up the esophagus.
And back into the lungs. Aspiration again.
Exactly. Aspiration is the biggest enemy.
Right.
That is why we have the 30-degree rule.
Which means keeping the bed elevated.
The head of the bed must be elevated at least 30 to 45 degrees at all times during feeding. You can basically never feed someone while they're lying flat.
It's just physics. Keep the food down.
And you have to keep them sitting up for 30 to 60 minutes after the feeding stops. Imagine chugging a liter of smoothie and then immediately lying flat on your back.
I would feel awful.
Now imagine doing that with a plastic tube holding your throat open. It's a recipe for aspiration pneumonia. We also check what's called gastric residual volumes, or GRV.
That's checking how much food is left sitting in the stomach from the last feed, right?
Right. There is actually some controversy in the medical field on whether checking GRV actually predicts aspiration effectively, but it is still standard practice to measure it.
There was one other safety innovation I wanted to highlight from the standards because it's such a simple, brilliant design fix. The ENFit connector.
Oh, that was a critical shift in the safety world.
It exists to solve the misconnection problem. I'm guessing that's exactly what it sounds like.
It is a nightmare scenario.
Yeah.
Picture a tired nurse at 3 a.m. The patient has an IV line in their arm for medication and a feeding tube in their nose. The tubes look similar. And historically, the connectors at the ends look similar.
Oh, no.
If you accidentally plug the feeding formula into the IV line.
You're putting blended food directly into their veins.
Yes. And that is catastrophic. It is life-threatening within minutes.
So the ENFit connector is a physical redesign, right? A reverse lure lock.
Exactly. It's the square peg, round hole solution. They changed the physical shape of the connector for feeding tubes globally.
Yeah.
It is mechanically impossible to plug an ENFit feeding tube into an IV line. It just will not click together.
I love that. Relying on human vigilance is hard when you're exhausted. Relying on physics is much better.
Always. It physically prevents the error.
So we've covered the mechanics for adults. But the pediatric guidelines, the section on tiny humans, that really stressed me out. Because everything is smaller and the margin for error seems way tighter.
It is tighter. The anatomy is different, not just smaller.
Yeah. The measuring technique changes. For adults, the nurse measures from the nose to the ear to the xiphoid process on the chest. But for kids, the tech says that's not deep enough.
Right. For children, the guidelines specifically say to measure nose to ear to mid umbilicus.
The belly button.
Yes. If you use the adult measurement on an infant, the tube might end up just hanging out in the esophagus.
Which means they aspirate immediately when you push the food.
Exactly.
And then there's the insertion itself. An adult might hate it, but you can reason with them. You can say, hold still, swallow some water, a 6-month-old baby.
There is no reasoning there. They are going to fight you. They will grab the tube. That is why nurses have to use what is called a mummy restraint.
That sounds absolutely medieval.
It sounds worse than it is, but it's basically a very tight swaddle. You wrap a sheet securely around their body and arms so they cannot reach up and rip the tube out while you were trying to navigate that tiny nasal passage. It's for their safety, but it is very hard for parents to watch.
But the part of the pediatric guidelines that actually got me emotional was the concept of non-nutritive sucking.
That is so important for their development.
I'd love for you to explain that connection for the listener.
Well, think about an infant. Their whole world is oral. They associate sucking with comfort, with fullness, with safety. If you bypass the mouth and just pump food directly into their stomach, they get full, but their brain doesn't register that satisfaction.
They feel full but unsatisfied.
Right. And over time, they can actually lose the instinct to suck entirely. So while the tube is feeding them, you give the infant a pacifier.
You trick the brain.
You link the two sensations. The baby feels, I am sucking on this pacifier and my tummy is getting full. It preserves that psychological pathway so that hopefully, one day, they can transition back to eating by mouth normally.
That is amazing. It's such a small detail, but it makes so much sense. Now, looking at the other end of the age spectrum, we have geriatrics. What changes when we're dealing with older adults?
The biggest hidden danger for older adults is decreased thirst perception. As we age, our thirst mechanism naturally gets weaker. The signal that says, hey, drink some water, is essentially broken.
So they can be dangerously dehydrated and not even feel it.
Exactly. And remember our conversation about osmolality?
The crowded party.
Right. Oh. If a highly concentrated formula causes diarrhea, an older adult can get severely dehydrated very fast, and they won't ask for water to replace it.
Plus, the texts noted that their heart function is often compromised.
Right. Heart failure is common. You can't just pump liters of extra fluid into them to hydrate them. If you do, you might flood their lungs from the inside, causing pulmonary edema.
So it's a tightrope walk.
It really is. That's why we often use those super concentrated 2.0 kilocalorie formulas. It delivers the required nutrition in a much smaller volume of liquid to protect the heart.
Too much fluid, heart failure. Too concentrated, diarrhea and dehydration.
It requires constant vigilant monitoring.
Well, we've covered the physics, the chemistry, the dangers, but I want to end on the human element. Because we can talk about French sizes and pH strips all day, but at the end of the day, there is a person attached to this plumbing.
And that person is dealing with a massive, life-altering loss.
The psychological impact of losing the meal.
Just think about your own life. Holidays, dates, business meetings, family gatherings. What are they all centered around?
Breaking bread. Eating.
Exactly. When you take that away, it is incredibly isolating. Patients mourn the loss of tasting and chewing. I have seen patients sit at the dinner table with their family just to feel part of it, but watching everyone else taste and enjoy food while you are hooked up to a whirring pump, it is psychologically brutal.
And physically, it's not just, you know, missing the taste of pizza. There is a real physical discomfort aspect to the hardware.
Oh, absolutely. The tube is taped securely to your face. Over time, it can cause pressure sores on the nostril, which we call MDRPI, or medical device-related pressure injuries. It's an actual wound from the plastic constantly pressing against the skin.
And the oral hygiene part really surprised me in the readings. The notes said nurses have to be obsessive about brushing the patient's teeth and cleaning the mouth, even though they aren't eating a single thing. My first thought was, why? They aren't getting food stuck in their teeth.
It's not about food debris. It is about bacteria. When you don't eat or drink, your mouth gets extremely dry. Your saliva production changes, and the mouth becomes a breeding ground for nasty bacteria.
And let me guess, aspiration again.
You got it. If they aspirate even a tiny bit of that bacteria-filled saliva while they sleep, it goes straight down into the lungs. It is one of the leading causes of pneumonia in tube-fed patients.
So you have to meticulously brush the teeth of a person who hasn't eaten in months just to save their lungs.
Correct. It is a full-body ecosystem. You can't just fix the stomach without tending to the mouth and the lungs.
It really highlights that this is a life-sustaining therapy, but it is a heavy burden. It's not just a switch you flip to fix starvation.
It is a bridge. Sometimes it's a bridge to full recovery, and sometimes it's a bridge to manage a chronic illness.
Mm.
But it requires immense trust from the patient. You are trusting the medical team to verify placement, to keep the bed elevated, to keep the lines clean.
So let's wrap this up. Enteral nutrition is basically high-stakes plumbing for the human body.
It is. It relies on the physiological logic of use the gut if you have it. It requires specialized hardware like the Salem sump to prevent vacuum damage.
It demands serious detective work. Real proof like x-rays and pH tests, not just listening for a fake whoosh sound.
And it requires engineered safety locks like the EnFit connector, so we physically cannot make fetal misconnection mistakes.
But mostly it demands a lot of empathy for the person who has lost one of the most basic human pleasures.
Absolutely. Empathy is the most important part of the care.
I want to leave you with a thought today. We view eating as a biological necessity. We do it to fuel the engine and stay alive. But if you could never taste your favorite food again, never have that morning coffee, never bite into a crisp apple, but you had perfect nutrition pumped directly into your stomach every day, you would be alive. But how would that change who you are? How much of your identity is tied up in the simple act of sitting down for a meal?
That is a very heavy question.
Something to chew on, metaphorically speaking. Thanks for diving deep into the sources with us today.
Take care, everyone.